Good morning.
I'm so grateful to be back with you and particularly to be in this sacred space with each of you and to be in flesh with one another. I brought with me this stone from the Kittatinny Ridge in eastern Pennsylvania. I've lived in Detroit almost my whole life, but 2 years ago my family and I moved to the mountains of Kirkridge Retreat Center, which has for a long time been a place of rest and imagination, of resistance and beloved community. And Kirkridge is on Lenni Lenape land, and a few months ago I was walking around with Shelley DePaul, who's one of the Lenape clan mothers in the area, and she said, "Do you know about stones?" She said, "When a prayer is prayed over a stone, that prayer never leaves the stone." And I think about that a lot, being on the mountain, which is stone upon stone upon stone, and Kirkridge's history, which in the time of the mountain is short, but it's been about 82 years, and the founding slogan was picket and pray. So this idea that struggle and prayer have always been linked, and I think about all the prayers that have been prayed decade over decade on these stones. And so I bring one of them today into this space to bring a little bit of earth with us, but also to know that all of these prayers are in this stone and we can feel them, and also really grateful that all of the prayers that we hold today become part of the history of this stone. When I was a child, my dad would watch the weather forecast in the winter, and when it was going to be really cold for a long time, he would go out to our backyard in southwest Detroit and get out the hose, and he would spray the backyard. And then 4 hours later, he would go back out and he would spray the backyard, and after a couple days, my sister and I had this incredible ice rink that we would get to play on for weeks, and we would skate around the apple tree and the picnic table, and it was total magic. And my kids are now 11 and 8, and they know that backyard really well. They've climbed that apple tree 100 times, and we've had so many meals at that old picnic table, but they're never going to know what it's like to skate in that backyard. It doesn't stay cold long enough to freeze. It gets cold, and then it gets warm, and then it gets cold, and it doesn't stay cold long enough to be able to make it into an ice rink. And I think about that all the time in the brief history between my childhood and theirs, and all the ways that we can see that climate has shifted. Climate change is all around us, and we feel it in little ways, like picking cherries a little earlier each year, and in big ways as we fear for those in our community at a distance who are evacuated for flood or fire or hurricane. The rains are falling harder, the snow is coming less, aqueducts are drying up, fires are spreading so much faster, the air grows toxic, songbirds are growing quiet, mountaintops are being harvested, topsoil is drifting away, plastic is filling the oceans. It's too much. And I think so many of us have faced some small climate catastrophe, and if we haven't, we probably will soon. And I think that this loss is living in our bodies, and how do we do anything but weep? There are days I can feel totally consumed by the grief and the anxiety and fear. And then I reach for the hand of my 8-year-old, who pulls me outside and sits me down to watch a cicada emerging from its skin. And I feel everything in my being change and shift. And I'm so overwhelmed with gratitude and awe for the children in my life. And I'm following their lead daily. Again and again, they lead me towards beauty, towards miracles. They slow me down, and their capacity for wonder and questions is infectious. So much of my work these days is thinking about what it means to lean in to our children's dreams and questions and follow those, and also, what are those bone lessons I want for my kids as we step into this next moment? And I want to be really clear that when I say our children, I mean that in the broadest sense of the word, that family is large and abundant as far as our imaginations can stretch, and all of us are wrapped up in the lives of the next generation in one way or another, whether as aunts and uncles or grandparents or teachers or neighbors or even just in this community here. In moments when I feel really overwhelmed, I often think about the words from Senegalese environmentalist Baba Diom, who says, "You can't save a place that you don't love. You can't love a place that you don't know. And you can't know a place you haven't learned." I'm going to say that one more time. You can't save a place that you don't love. You can't love a place that you don't know. And you can't know a place that you haven't learned. And I think some of the most important and radical work that we can do is help our children fall in love and learn the place, the land that holds them. That this learning becomes knowing, and this knowing becomes loving, and once you love something, it can change everything. Once you love a place and you see harm coming, you can't not put your body in the way. So I think we get to do this simple work of watershed literacy, and that can look a million different ways. We can learn the names of bugs and trees and birds. We can lie down on our bellies and watch the caterpillar get fat as it eats the milkweed. We can wander our neighborhoods in search of wild edibles and wild grapevines and tiger lilies and Queensland lace roots. We can let mud get between our toes. We can climb apple trees. With every moment that we squander in our watershed to which we belong, we're learning our place. We're falling in love. And we pray that that changes everything. Jimmy Boggs, who's a longtime organizer in Detroit, now ancestor, said revolutions are made of love of people and love of place. So if we love our neighbors with everything we've got and we fall head over heels for the oak trees and the wild raspberries, then we're going to have to build a revolution. 3 billion birds have gone missing in U.S. and Canada since 1970. 90% of those species are ones we see on a daily basis, from sparrows to blackbirds, warblers, finches. 92 million red-winged blackbirds alone have disappeared. We continue to create ecosystems where birds can no longer survive. The species are shrinking and disappearing everywhere, and I worry that so much of it is happening without us even noticing. And it's not only creatures and birds and trees that are being wiped out, but language itself. We're forgetting their names. The Oxford Junior Dictionary every now and then reevaluates the words that are in the dictionary. They have to make room for what are the new words that have meaning in our lives and what are no longer relevant. And you can imagine in the last 15 years, most of those words are technology words, broadband, email, cut and paste, all of these words that need to be added to the dictionary. But what's coming out are words like acorn, willow, dandelion. In 2007, the Oxford Junior Dictionary removed 50 nature words. And in 2012, another 50. Bluebell, fern, kingfisher, otter. These words aren't necessary for our children anymore. They're not being taught. They're not being learned. And I wonder what the cost is. How will our children notice if the blue herons are disappearing if they don't even know what they're called? So the simple act of naming becomes a way of remembering, of paying attention, of determining what has value in our lives. The simple act of language becomes resistance. So we learn their names, white-throated sparrow, northern cardinal, mourning dove, so that if they start to go silent, we'll notice. In the reading this morning in Mark, Jesus is baptized into the Jordan. It's a big transformation moment that shifts the course of his life. And for the last decade or so, I've been part of communities that are using the language of watershed discipleship. What does it mean to be a disciple to your place? This radical idea that our allegiance is not based on political boundaries, but on a commitment to everyone and every creature that is fed by the same water. When I imagine this morning for Jesus, I think that there must have been a lot churning in him. He had been witnessing since the day he was born, the power of empire around him, the military might of Herod, the economic injustice around him. Vocation and spirit were rumbling in his belly, and he's listening. And he's moving more and more to the margins, following his cousin's vision. And John has found his way into community by being in relationship with the wilderness. He's living off the land, filling his belly with locusts and honey. And it's there in that place that Jesus takes off his shoes, puts his feet on the ground, and walks into the waters. He gets in the water, and fish swim around him, and wild birds fly overhead. Spirit is flowing in this wild place. And then Jesus decides to go even deeper into the wilderness for a while, to live among the wild animals, and to let this churning move him into the next moments of his life. I think that the Bible is such a juicy, earthy text, and I fear that we have tamed it. How do we recover the wildness on these pages? Jesus is constantly in relationship with his watershed. The stories take place in rivers and seas and up a mountain, and the stories are full of fish and bread and wheat and grapes and donkeys and palms and seeds, and they're not metaphors. They're the living, breathing reality of the discipleship's lives. So if Jesus was here today in this moment, what water would Jesus be baptized into? What bird would descend? And how do we get baptized into our watersheds? I know for me, it was the Detroit River that summoned me in and rearranged who I was. Where are we headed with climate change? I don't know. One possibility is that we get this right. We let our imaginations carry us and our love of the world drive us, and we shift and we make big changes, learning to live in new ways and reclaim old ways, and we transition death-dealing profit systems to life-giving generous ones, and it's marvelous. And another possibility is that we don't get it right, and weather gets more volatile and politics get more deadly, that systems crumble and we face into the worst. I don't know, and I can oscillate between both and a million possibilities in the middle. What I do know is that either way doesn't change how I want to live. I want to be immersed in these waters. I want to fall in love with the red-winged blackbirds and let that change everything. I want to pour my life into struggle with all the grief and all the joy. I want to fight like hell and grow tomatoes. I want to worship with the praying mantis. I want to learn how to build composting toilets. I want to play with my kids and sing in the wind. I want to honor the dead and feed the birds. Either way doesn't change that there can be joy and laughter, awe and wonder, love and community. Either way sharpens my gaze on what matters and what doesn't. Either way, I want to live humanly and invite our kids into deeper knowing of what it means to be alive on this sweet earth. That's our discipleship call. These are the waters that we're being called into. Mario Benedetti writes this glorious poem, Por qué cantamos, and this is a translation and a short piece of it. If each hour brings death, if time is a den of thieves, the breezes carry a scent of evil, and life is just a moving target, you will ask why we sing. We sing because the river is humming, and when the river hums, the river hums. We sing because cruelty has no name, but we can name its destiny. We sing because the child, because everything, because the future, because the people. We sing because the survivors and our dead want us to sing. So, dear friends, may these be days of singing. O God of the wild waters and the ancient stones, who dwells in the bellies of the honeybees and the roots of the grandmother oak, submerge our bodies and lives into the waters that claim us, calling us to fall more deeply in love with the white pines and the salamanders, and all of creation, which we are a part. And may that love change everything. May we enter these waters and rise up singing, because the river is humming, and when the river hums, the river hums. We sing because we cannot do otherwise. Amen.